Hello, and welcome back to the Why You Know Doctor podcast. This is where we share stories from Asian leaders to empower and inspire the next generation. My name is Dominic, and I'm your host. So on our show, we have real, uncensored conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and other professionals. Through these conversations, I hope to inspire listeners like you to pursue what you really want to, while also making sure that you have the right mindset or advice to actually help you succeed along the way. So anyways, without further ado, enjoy this week's episode. Super excited to have Rihanna Singh on the podcast today. She's the founder and CEO of Boss Women Collective. And based on your website and based off what I've read so far, you guys are a community that works to connect and empower women in real life through intimate experiences. So thanks for taking the time and hopping on.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really excited to be on the podcast.
Yeah, so I wanted to just dive a little bit deeper into like into your company, Boss Women Collective. I mean, what does it mean, empowering women in real life through intimate experiences? Is it like meetups or what exactly is it?
Yeah, so it's really focused on crafting relationships that go outside of your screen. I think especially nowadays where it's really easy to connect with people across a lot of different social platforms, I wanted to create spaces that you can come and actually meet someone in real life, whether you're talking about a show that you just binge watched on Netflix or asking for salary negotiation tips. I feel like because everything is becoming so tech focused, it's really nice to be able to have those in-person contacts.
Got it. So is it just... So what would be like some of the typical people that like their backgrounds and like what are some of the events that normally people go to or maybe are they just ad hoc? Like,
we're currently based in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. So it really depends on the market and what people are interested in. We like to think of ourselves as being somewhat industry agnostic. But I would say on average, the women part of our community are within the first 5 to 10 years of their career. So maybe they're in their first or second job out of college or out of school. And we really focus on different panels, different workshops, different career sessions that really just allow you to lean on other people that are in the same boat or same situation as you so that we can all learn and grow together.
Got it. That makes sense. And so how did you get this idea to, first of all, I think it's a great idea. And I've always thought that, I've used like apps like Meetup and stuff like that before. And I've always found it really, whenever you can find the right group of people, it can be really, really beneficial. The challenge sometimes I think is finding like the group of people that you really click with.
I definitely agree. And I think the hardest thing, a lot of people say, what's the difference between Boss Women Collective versus just a meetup that you see on Eventbrite or on Meetup? I think kind of going back to how it started, I had just graduated UCLA and I was in the process of looking for a new job, but also at the same time, a lot of my friends had moved out of the city to pursue their first full-time job after school. So I was in this weird boat where I wanted to make new friends, but I also wanted to make new business connections because I was looking for a job. So I thought, why isn't there an opportunity to connect both of those worlds together in a way that felt very organic, where I would actually want to hang out with these people outside of talking about LinkedIn. So I wanted to create kind of like a safe and fun place where you can have the best of both worlds. And that's kind of how Boss Women Collective started, really diving into the fact that you can have these professional conversations but also make personal connections.
That's awesome. Have you made some like pretty good friends so far, or do people that go to some of these events, has it become kind of like pretty tight of a community, or do you still have a lot of outside people, new people coming in as well?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on what the topic of the event is. So I moved to San Francisco about 8 months, and I would say about 90% of my network are women that I've met through Boss Women Collective, which is really exciting. So it's definitely really great when you're moving to a new city that we have a presence in and you want to find a non-intimidating place to meet new people. And I think a lot of people have that same sentiment. I've heard time and time again, people refer to Boss Women Collective as a non-lame networking group, which is definitely a compliment. But I think it really depends on what you're looking for when you come into an event, whether it's to make new connections or to learn new things, and then kind of running at it from there.
Got it. Cool. So are most of the people like all from the US? They've just like moved to new cities or
Yeah, I would say it's a pretty big mix, just because our marketing efforts and the network effect of a friend telling their friend, it is somewhat stays under a certain category of young women, professionals working in tech, working in media, different careers, whether it's college friends letting other friends know about the events. We are trying to broaden our scope, and we're expanding to a few additional cities this upcoming year. So it will be interesting to see how our overall demographic changes as we expand.
Got it. Cool. No, that's awesome. Okay, so then just back a little bit into your background. So what did you study at UCLA?
Yes, sir. I actually started UCLA as an econ major, and I was really excited about what I was learning until it started getting very stats heavy. Quickly realized that me and math were not best friends, and I pivoted into an Asian American Studies major, which I actually had no idea that was even something you could major in. It started from me taking a GE around Asian American women. And I was so moved by what I was learning and the overall topic that I felt like this is something that I wanted to pursue further and learn more about. And I made the decision to transfer into that major.
Got it. And you said, what were some of those things or topics that you just mentioned that like really excited you, and like what specifically?
Yeah, so I never really, I'm Indian, but I never really knew like what that meant or the different, the history attached to that, just because I was born here and my parents are pretty Americanized, even though my mom was born in India. So hearing topics about like post 9/11, what it means to be brown or South Asian or Desi in America, or learning about different forms of injustice and racism, it was something that definitely hit home for me. And like hearing stories about like my grandparents and how they've navigated life in America. So I think that it kind of sparked a curiosity to want to learn more about like where I came from and what the different struggles that like my parents and their parents went through. And I think having that like attachment to my history and wanting to, do something greater with like my voice and my sense of curiosity is kind of what encouraged me to want to pursue this and see how I could tie it back into what my passions were professionally around marketing, around business, and kind of merging those two together.
Got it. Cool. And just curious, did you, where did you grow up? Like, what was the community like where you grew up as a kid?
Yeah. So I grew up in Riverside, California, which is about an hour and a half away from Los Angeles. But I went to a private Christian school my entire life, from kindergarten to 12th grade, the same school. So a lot of the individuals that I went to kindergarten with, I actually graduated high school with them. But my school was very, very ethnically diverse. So I never understood at all, like any sense of like hierarchy or, like minorities. It was very beautiful in that sense, but I think it was a huge culture shock going to UCLA and seeing, people hanging out in their pods. You hang out with people who look like you. There's a lot of like groups that form and cliques, and it was just a very much a culture shock there. But I think that my upbringing really encouraged me, and it allowed me to see the beauty in hanging out with people from different walks of life, so that you have more of a holistic perspective on society.
Yeah. Did you, have you ever been to India? Like, I know like your mom grew up there, so maybe you have some, or your mom was born there at least. Maybe you have some family there still.
Yeah. So, my mom moved, came here when she was 2 years old. So, I don't currently have any family left in India. Everyone moved to the States, and I have not been to India yet. I really want to go at some point. I just haven't had the opportunity to go there, but I'm hoping to go there soon.
Okay, cool. Because I was asking, because when I was, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I know one of the things that really changed my, life was the first time that I went to China, and, I studied abroad. Actually, no, I didn't study abroad there. I was 16 years old. Somehow my brother had my brother had went to China. He was like, you know, 6 years older. So it made sense. He went with some friends to go backpacking when he was like 20 something. But I was like, yeah, I want to go too. And, you know, my first girlfriend and I went together, and she was like 15, or maybe she just turned 16. And like, I don't think her parents knew that we were just going to go like alone together, but like, pretty crazy. We were 16 and we like backpacked in China for like 2.5 weeks by ourselves. And, but that really just changed my entire like perspective of everything. And it really made me feel a lot closer to my identity. I'm Chinese American. Mm-hmm. And I know like even in college, I took some classes that were Asian American studies. I actually did a double major, and one was in Chinese. And because those are all influenced by like just going to China and feeling like, just feeling like, I don't know, just feeling like I wanted to know more. That's all. I was just more curious. And it's really like, it just impacted my whole life, I think.
Yeah. And I've heard similar sentiments from a lot of friends who wanted to have that deeper connection to where they're from or where their parents are from. So definitely hope that I can make my way to India and have a similar experience.
Yeah. I think, that'd be really exciting. Okay, cool. So you studied Asian American studies, started with econ, studied Asian American studies. That was your major. And then how did you bridge like getting into like the tech industry? Were people ever like, what are you gonna do after you graduate and stuff like that?
Yeah, literally everyone was like, what are you going to do with your major, and how is that going to tie into what you're interested in professionally? I think when I was doing Asian American studies as an undergrad, I wasn't actually interested in tech at that point. I was pursuing undergraduate internships under like the marketing umbrella. So a lot of social media, digital marketing, and advertising. And I think the angle that I took with it is, when you're an Asian American studies major, I think people think on the outside that you're just taking history classes on, you know, maybe like what it means to be Asian American or what that story was for Asian Americans coming here. But a lot of it was a really, I had a very intersectional approach where you're taking creative writing classes, history classes. You know, there is like the business econ aspect of it to a certain extent. So my angle was, I really wanted to understand the stories of marginalized groups or underrepresented groups. And how they're able to use that narrative to like craft a new story for themselves. And I really wanted to tie that into marketing and understanding the importance of having diversity of perspectives when it comes to building marketing campaigns or the individuals that you decide to highlight. So I think I was really trying to play up the storytelling aspect of it, because that's something that I think I'm naturally really good at. Of course, you know, you have the people that are skeptical, and I'm sure that there were a lot of internships and jobs I didn't get because, you know, people might have seen my resume and looked at my major and saw that it wasn't marketing. But I realized that if someone didn't want to accept me for an interview because I was an Asian American Studies major, then that's not somewhere that I would want to work anyways.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And then, okay, cool. So then afterwards, did you dive straight into, I think you did a few internships actually, right? Like at a bunch of different tech companies. Is that kind of first how you got going?
Yeah. So the first, I guess, tech related company that I did an internship at was ClassPass. I interned at ClassPass for a little bit after I graduated UCLA before accepting my first full-time role in tech at Headspace, which is a meditation app.
Yeah, it's a good app. Do you use it?
I do. I use it every night for the sleep sounds and meditations, and I feel like I've kind of come to learn what it means to be mindful. So even when I'm not using the app, I still try to maintain the same like underlying philosophies.
Got it. What does it mean to be mindful for you personally?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because it can mean something different for each person. I think for me personally, about how I see being mindful, just trying to be more present of my surroundings. And when I'm with people, try to give them my undivided attention, not let my thoughts wander when I'm in conversation or doing different tasks. So sometimes it can feel counterintuitive or productive when you're, you know, have so many things on your mind. But I think focusing on one thing at a time is my like ideal sense of how I practice being more mindful.
Yeah, it's difficult. I know sometimes I'm just like myself spacing out.
Yeah, exactly.
I really like Headspace. It's always, I know a lot of people that like use it every morning. Some people use it before they go to sleep. I was using it every morning for a while. Really recommend it to anyone that hasn't tried it. So what did you do at Headspace, and how long were you there for?
Yeah, so I was at Headspace for around a year and a half, and I started working on our Headspace for Work team, which basically focuses on getting Headspace as an app for employees as a mental health benefit. So it was really exciting. My job was talking to a lot of organizations and leaders within those organizations who are really focused on adding benefits to the workplace to help their employees when it comes to productivity or stress or overall mental well-being. So I was working on the sales team to bring Headspace into various workplaces.
Okay, got it. And then, at what point were you just like, because I think Boss Women Collective started just as like a blog or something, like a side, was it just like a side hustle of something that you're just interested in? When did that start at the same time? Or?
It started around the same time. I hosted my first meetup in January 2018, and I got my job at Headspace that February. So it was very casual that I was starting Boss Women Collective on the side as an Instagram page, kind of just posting memes and fun content to see, if this is a product that people are interested in, if there was a fit in the market. But it was definitely something, as you mentioned, that I saw very much as a side hustle, something just as like a creative networking outlet on the side of my full-time job.
Got it. And like, at what point did you like decide to like start to invest more time into it? Like, and like kind of see it as something being bigger than just like a blog?
Yeah. So it honestly I didn't see the potential for it until I moved to San Francisco, which was about 8 months ago. I think the really interesting thing about LA is that it's somewhat hard to bring people together, because if someone lives on one side of the 405, it's a huge deal for them to cross that freeway to go to an event on the other side. It's impossible. And it's so many people joke around how it feels like you're in a long distance relationship when you're with someone like 6 miles away, because traffic is so bad. So I feel like
unless you go hang out, at like 4 in the morning or something.
Exactly. You very much have to utilize like an off-peak hour. So I think it was a little bit harder for me to feel really inspired and encouraged to start it there, because to get traction for our events. But I think moving to San Francisco has helped, because I think San Francisco is like a 7x7 area. So it's a little bit easier to bring people together with public transportation, less traffic, and a lot of different external factors.
Got it. That makes sense. I know, like I lived in LA for a while, and it's just like, it's crazy. I just had friends that lived in like Koreatown. I would be like, yeah, it's too far. can't go. I lived in Westwood.
Exactly. Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly. And everyone can always blame traffic. So it's like, oh yeah, sorry, traffic's too bad. And no one really has a rebuttal for that, because it's just literally the lay of the land.
Yeah. So do you like living in San Francisco more than LA?
So I never saw myself moving to San Francisco ever. I was dead set on moving back to New York. I lived in New York briefly when I did a summer internship, but I got the opportunity to move here for a tech job, and I felt that it was close enough where if I missed LA, it was a quick hour flight back down. I do like it. I didn't like it the first few months because I kept comparing it to LA, but once I started accepting San Francisco at face value for all the various nuances of the city, it allowed me to appreciate living here a little bit more.
Yeah. What are some of like those special things? The reason I'm asking, actually, even for some personal reasons, is I'm curious, like I'm possibly considering moving to LA. San Francisco.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I'm just curious, like what are some of those like nuances and things that you really like about the city and don't like?
Well, one thing... Oh, and what I don't like, I would say what I really like about the city is that everything is very close by and it's somewhat easy to get around with the public transportation. So because majority of the tech companies are either like South Bay, South San Francisco or downtown, all of your friends who also work in tech all work in the same area versus LA, it's very spread out across different parts of town. So I like that. If I send someone a text like, hey, let's get dinner after work, I know that they're probably about a 10-minute walk from where I am at any given point. So it's just a lot easier to coordinate meeting up with people. And then I think that if you're working in tech, it's an amazing place to be because almost everyone works in tech. But on the flip side, if you're coming here for maybe more of like a creative field, it can feel a little not intimidating, but maybe you don't feel that you can as strongly build your network versus maybe LA or New York, where there's a lot more creative individuals that are living and working in the city. So I think it really depends on like what you're looking to accomplish or be surrounded by in SF. And if that's something that the city is kind of like building or fostering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I know like sometimes I try to think like, have you been to many places in Europe?
A few, not as many as I would like, but is there a certain place that it's like similar to? Or?
Well, and I was just thinking in general, you know, like European cities are much more like walkable usually and like close together. Yeah. And it's so nice. Like, it's like, I think San Francisco, I think there's only a few cities in the US that are kind of like that, like the bigger ones. Like, for example, like, I think New York is probably kind of, I don't know, I've never lived in New York, but I think it's pretty dense, right? Like, so probably, I don't know, what's more walkable to like just hang out in like community, like, you know, like the same thing that you're talking about with like San Francisco, like compared to New York? Is it similar?
It's definitely, San Francisco is more like walkable than, LA for sure, but they also have the hills, so you can turn a corner and then you see like a gigantic hill and you're like, that was not on the map for like a 0.7 mile like walk. I think New York is just like tops it all. It's so easy to get around the city, and even for Boston Collective events, we've seen the most success with New York because no matter where you are, there's a subway line that'll get you to where you need to go. So it definitely makes it a lot easier to bring people together from different parts of town.
Got it. I was just thinking like, you know, it's nice to be able to live in a place where you can just like not have to have a car, right? Like you can rely on public transportation and walking, and it's so convenient. But you know, many US places, you just can't really do that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, cool. And so just back to like a little bit about like the platform, Boss Women Collective. So how long have you guys been around now?
So we've been around for just about 2 years from when we officially did our first event. Nice. But I would say probably about 8 months since I really started investing in like building it and trying to scale it across different markets.
Okay, got it. And what were some of like the biggest challenges so far? Just you know, building that platform. It's obviously not easy because it's really about a community, I think, right? So it's like, I don't know, I've tried to build communities before. They're not easy to do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you think about like launching a product or, you know, building like a direct to consumer brand, nowadays there's a lot of companies doing it. So there's like a playbook that you can find online, but there's not really a playbook to build a brand or community that's focused on someone really aligning with your mission and wanting to help amplifying your mission across like their social platforms and attending events where they don't know anyone. So I think we're kind of in this very new space. So it's been a little hard for us to find other examples of organizations that we're hoping to like emulate or align our values to. So I think the hardest thing is really just constantly testing and learning and figuring out what's working, what's not working, and then running from there. It is kind of just me identifying like, hey, let's try this. And I think one of the biggest things that I've learned is just being like highly adaptable and not being so tied down to a specific idea. If you see it's not working, kind of just like really letting your pride go aside. But yeah, I think those are kind of the main things that we've been focusing on in trying to get this up and running.
You got it. What are some like the big things that you guys have just like maybe some like the lessons learned or things that didn't work?
Yeah. So when we first launched, we are decided to do an ambassador program because our DMs were constantly flooded with women from Boston, Austin, Seattle, Toronto, where they wanted to bring meetups to their cities. So we launched an ambassador program, but we realized that we didn't provide the ambassadors enough clarity and tools and resources to be able to fully execute an event, a pop-up event by themselves. So it was like this really interesting struggle of having women from all these like one-off cities that were so excited about doing something, but we didn't know exactly how to empower them to do so with the right tools. So with our first version of the program, we felt it was somewhat counterintuitive to our mission of connecting women in real life if we were building this digital connection of ambassadors. So with our second version of the program, we've redesigned the playbook, focused on allowing kind of like a plug-and-play strategy for hosting an event in different cities. So now we've kind of got it down to 3 weeks from having the strategy to fully executing it and making it a successful event. So that kind of just came from testing and learning and seeing what our community is craving.
Got it. So how do you, when someone sets up like a pop-up event, is it sometimes just like a meetup at like a restaurant or like a bar or like where usually are those like meetings held at?
Yeah, so we definitely try to utilize public spaces because, when you think about like doing an event at a restaurant or a bar, it's generally like $50 per head for like a 3-course meal. And we're all about access to resources. So we never want price to be a factor where someone wouldn't be able to attend an event. So we try to do it at coffee shops, which is kind of our bread and butter of how we initially launched our community. And then kind of going into collaboration spaces with co-working spaces, corporate sponsors, or different shops that would like us to utilize their space during off-peak hours.
Got it. And then what are some like the biggest successes that you've had so far in the last couple of years with the collective?
Yeah, I would say two come top of mind. So the first paid event that we tested was last month with AngelList. Their headquarters in San Francisco. And we did an event focused on what the future of venture capital will look like for women. And we completely sold out the event, over 100 tickets. So that was really exciting. And then most recently in New York for Galentine's Day, we did a self-love and self-care panel. And we had over 300 individuals sign up for it. And we had a wait list. So I think it kind of really showed that there is a lot of interest for our events in our emerging markets and really show that we need to double down and trying to craft more community-focused experiences on a frequent basis.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. So that event that was done with like AngelList, so that was about, you said like the future of like VCs for like in regards with women or what was the topic?
Yeah. Yeah, the future of venture capital for women. So kind of thinking about the overall ecosystem, increasing the number of investors that are women, as well as, female-founded companies that are getting investments overall in terms of raising rounds of funding.
Is it pretty difficult today? I don't work in the tech industry, really. I mean, kind of, sort of, but not really. I'm sure there's like a big disparity or whatever between like men and women in venture capital, but just like how much of a difference is there? Like, what are some of the biggest problems today?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is the percentage of women that are actually investors. So whether that's like the entry-level positions, like analysts or associates, are looking at like the partner level. There are more organizations that are trying to get women into these roles. But if you're thinking of like a hiring table where it's all men, bringing that first woman onto the team is seen as a big deal. Kind of bringing her into that ecosystem. So I think with every industry that's maybe deemed to be a little bit more male dominated, I think the biggest thing is, of course, getting, more seats at the table filled by women, and then allowing and encouraging those women to also bring up other women along with them, which kind of goes back to one of my favorite quotes where it's important to lift others as you're rising yourself. And I think that's like a perfect example of how how you can go about getting more women into spaces that are male dominated.
I think the challenge is also just like, because those spaces are so male dominated, like they've really like sent the elevator back down and found people similar to themselves and their own, like, I don't know, you know, and like then as a result, I mean, I don't know if this is true. This is totally speculative, but like, I feel like, I guess in your opinion, why is it that just like, is it just because like there's so many men at the top that they just hire other men like them, or?
Yeah, I think it has to come to the referral system where, you know, you're able to send a specific referral for the job listing. You realize that you're going to be spending up to, you know, 50, 60 hours a week with this person. You want to bring in someone that you can hang out with after work. And with that mentality, a lot of men especially refer their friends, and it becomes a cycle where you only, you know, bring on people to your team that look like you or think like you. You don't really encourage diversity of thought or different types of experiences and backgrounds into the workplace.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that's why there's also less, not just like women, but just minorities that come from different backgrounds in general, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm wondering what can be done, or what are some of the things being done in that space to help encourage? Because, you know, like one thing you mentioned before is like, you know, sending kind of like the elevator back down. But if there's not that many like women in those positions in the first place today, like, how are like the VC firms doing something, or I don't know, like, how's it going to
change? I think the biggest thing is having like executive sponsorship. If the leadership doesn't understand that this is a problem and that systems or, you know, best practices need to be implemented to help change the culture, then it's going to be really hard for middle managers to see why they should go about, you know, speaking up or making a change. So I think one, having that support from leadership in general, whether it's male leaders or female leaders. I also think the other thing is just in general, having male allies. So having individuals who recognize the privilege that they have, encouraging them to speak up and to use their voice, because I think, you know, it's a lot harder for the underrepresented groups in the workplace to have this fight and to battle it. But unless we have support from other individuals, I don't think that it's going to have, I don't think there's going to be an opportunity for effective change to be implemented. So I think top of mind, those are the two main things that I've seen help to work. But of course, there's so many other systems in place that do make it hard, even if those two items are kind of checked off.
Yeah. And for like a, you know, like when you worked in the tech space, and I guess you still do, like what was like the ratio of like men and women? I feel like everything I've heard is like San Francisco is just like really male dominated because of like the tech companies like being like heavily male, you know, the divide is like heavily male.
Yeah. So when I was working at Headspace, it was a pretty even ratio, honestly. I felt like my team was probably like a 50-50 split. When I moved to San Francisco and joined Uber, I definitely felt that my team specific, I know this does depend on the team that you're working on, it skewed more men than women. And I think that's something that's a little bit more prevalent for the tech industry in San Francisco specifically.
Was it challenging for you in any specific regards working at these tech companies? I think just first of all, being like a woman in general, or second of all, being like a minority woman when there's not that many others.
Yeah. I think that there's a few different reasons why I felt like it was a little bit hard moving to San Francisco, and specifically, you know, pertinent to my experience at Uber. So of course, one was like the woman aspect. I would say probably on a team of 20, maybe there were like three or four women on my team.
Oh, wow. That's not much.
It wasn't that bad, but it wasn't like I was the only one. I think the other thing is being the youngest woman, where I feel like not as many people talk about the effects of ageism in the workplace. But, you know, say you're the only woman in the room, you're the only woman of color, minority woman, and then you're the youngest person in general in that conference room. You have all of these like layers and factors kind of working against you almost, or maybe you internally feel like they're working against you. So I definitely felt like there were many, many times in meetings that I didn't say anything because whether it was imposter syndrome kicking in, but I felt like, who am I to say something, or how is this going to be perceived, or do I even feel like I've earned the right to state my opinion? And I think that looking back on it, say 6 months later, I was definitely like, I should have just said something. But of course, it's one of those situations where, you know, hindsight's 2020. But I think that a lot of other women that I've spoken to experience very similar things. And it's just a really unfortunate aspect of working in tech.
Mm-hmm. How do you get about that? Or is there any recommendations to like not, you know, I think it's challenging because obviously imposter syndrome that just affects everyone. You know, it affected me for a long time. Mm-hmm. In certain scenarios, it still does affect me. But, mm-hmm. you know, do you have any tips for you personally, or right now you're still, that's still something that you're working through yourself as well?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I'm still working through. And I think it's something that I'll constantly be working through. I think, you know, some tips that I've tried to implement is really taking a step back and understanding what value am I adding to the team? What are the unique experiences that I've gained over my career, whether it's 6 months or a 10-year career, that I think uniquely position me to have an opinion on this subject? And then when it comes to actually stating that opinion, I think there's little like nuances or words that women often use, especially younger women, you know, for example, saying, sorry, I didn't know this, or sorry, I messed up, sorry to bother you, sorry, I don't understand this. And I think that being a little bit more forward with your language really helps to combat imposter syndrome. So instead of saying like, excuse me, or do you have a minute to explain this, or can you help me understand how we came to this thought process? Those are a few things that I've been very forward about implementing in my day to day. And I think that's also helped me combat imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree about like the sorries. I feel like even, you know, I run a team of like 40 people. I'm always just like, whenever someone like leads the conversation with sorry, I'm like, dude, like, or just like whoever is like, please. It's like, that makes me like honestly feel uncomfortable that someone has like spent like all this time preparing this report or preparing this long email that's really thoughtful. And they're like, hey, sorry, this thing's a little bit, sorry. Like, I know you're busy, Bob. I'm like, you really need to stop apologizing. Like, you yeah. know, I really don't like it when people apologize for like everything. It's like, just like kind of like own what you did, you know?
Yeah. I actually did a challenge last year where I went 7 days without saying sorry. And I called it the hashtag I'm sorry challenge, inspired by Beyonce. And at the end of it, I definitely felt like I was more mindful of my language, but I started responding to people and asking them, what are you sorry for? And I think it also caught people off guard because they realized as well that they were saying sorry for things that they weren't actually sorry for. So that's definitely a quick little tip. If you notice a coworker or a peer saying it, to help that encourage them to be more mindful as well of the words they're using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great, great tip. I think you covered one of the, I think there was like another impactful moment I believe earlier, like you, I have some in my notes about like something about you like negotiating 30K plus through like some like insights provided by some other members or something. You know what I'm talking
about? Yeah, with Boston Collective.
Yeah, with Boston Collective. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that was actually a story from one of our members. We have an internal Slack channel where we'll lean on it to share advice or insights. And I think the really interesting and beautiful thing about Boston Collective is that we always like to say, you know, we encourage our members to trust the process and learn as they grow. And because, you know, we're within the first 5 years of our career, we don't necessarily have all the answers, but there is something really special about leaning on each other for insights. So that story was specifically from a member, Nikki, who had leaned on another member for insights on how to go about the salary negotiation part of an interview. And she mentioned that during that process, with the tips that she received from another member, she was able to negotiate for a higher salary. And I think it really just speaks to the fact that there's a lot that you can learn from peers. It doesn't always have to come from a mentor or a sponsor, but there's a lot of knowledge to be shared amongst women or individuals within their early career as well.
Got it. What what was like the tip? Was there something specific that like made her feel to negotiate better?
I think it really depends on the city that you're in, but the state that you're in. Each state has different laws around what a recruiter is able to ask you in the interview process. So for California specifically, they're not able to ask you about what you were previously making. And then also during an interview, another tip that a lot of people don't know is that if an interviewer or a recruiter asks you, what are your salary expectations? You're actually allowed to flip the question and ask them what's the pay range for this role. And they're legally obligated to tell you what that range is. So say if you were about to say, I'm looking for $65,000 for this role, but the pay range is actually between $75,000 and $100,000, you would have just shorted yourself $10,000. But because they have to give you that range, that allows you to kind of readjust the number that you're going to come back with after learning that information.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah, that's I didn't realize that. But do a lot of people like go through recruiters, or like how for you or other women, like generally, is that like a pretty common way that people get interviews, or is it just like through applying and stuff?
You're saying through like recruiters at the workplace?
No, I mean, like, so that example is for like a recruiter reached out to someone, right? And like asked them.
Yeah. So that would be like a common recruiter working at, say, like a Google or a Facebook and having that like a first initial phone call. That's mm-hmm. probably like the most common way that people have that interaction where salary negotiation would come up during the call.
Okay. Got it. Makes sense. Okay. Cool. So you know, like the Boss Women Collective, I think it's focused on the empowerment of women, and you being the founder of the company, your background is as an Asian American. Does that have a significant impact for you as you lead the company for the mission? And how does like your own culture or background like play into it at all?
Yeah, I would say that there's two big things that come top of mind there. The first one is that Asian American is like a really broad umbrella term. And, you know, if you're Indian versus if you're Chinese or Korean or, Filipino, you're going to have a very different experience. So I think we try to be mindful of the language that we use and understanding that people are coming to the table with their own experiences from their own walk of life. So I think, not trying to assume that I understand someone's story just because I know that they come from a specific background has been really important, even within the Indian community, whether you're from like North India or South India, or you were born in India or you're born in America. Everyone has like a very different story. And then I think the second one is, very similar to, the title of this podcast. A lot of people are navigating their professional experiences with parents that come from a very different generation and background. So a lot of people my age are navigating how do they pursue their passions and what they feel their purpose is with their parents' expectations of them. So I think we really try to open up that conversation, knowing that we're surrounding ourselves with women who are very ambitious. And how can we lean on each other as we're trying to really understand how can we add value to those around us while we're doing something that really excites us. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Cool. So I just have a few last questions. I wanted to ask just like for you personally, like what does success mean for you and how do you define it in your own life?
So I think if you would have asked me 3 years ago, I probably would have given you like a salary number that I was hoping to be at a certain point in my life. But mm-hmm. I think after my experiences at Uber and just moving to the tech industry, I don't equate success with making X amount per year. I think it's really feeling like you're going to work every single day, actually excited by what you're doing and feeling like you're making a difference. That's what I think is successful, because I know so many people who hate their jobs, but they're staying there for the money. And I never want to find myself in that situation. So I would say that, 2-3 years from now, if I say Rihanna, if someone says Rihanna's successful, I'm going to assume that means that I'm passionate and excited by what I'm doing. I know that I'm helping others in some way, shape, or form. And I feel like a sense of inspiration waking up in the morning to follow that North Star that I've identified.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And then what would be some advice that you would give to like maybe like someone that's just graduating high school and getting into college, that's a young woman that's, you know, about to whether start college or they're about to graduate college or move into like kind of like the real world? Is there any specific advice that you would share?
Yeah, I would say somewhat different advice, but the same underlying theme would be follow your curiosities. So I think whether, you know, you're starting college, if there's a class that interests you or a student organization or an internship, college is a perfect time to explore a lot of different things. And I think that you have that advantage that, you know, you're a student and that you can run at a lot of different things and seeing what sticks and what kind of sparks a sense of excitement. So that's kind of the advice that I would give to a high school student going into college. Upon graduating, I think that a lot of people in college, you know, ask you like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I think that's probably one of the worst questions that you can ask someone because it puts unnecessary pressure to feel like you need to have your life figured out once you graduate. So I would say have a plan, but be okay with not sticking to it because, you know, you might hate your first job out of college. You might realize that you're moving to a city that you never expected. Be okay with the fact that not everything is going to go according to a plan that you created. And with each obstacle or experience or problem that you face, try to really find the silver lining in it, because I think that'll make things a lot easier to navigate through when you have those highs and lows. If you're constantly trying to figure out, what is this experience teaching me? What can I learn from this?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like 5 years is such a long period of time too. It is and it isn't. But when I think like 5 years ago, I was like in such a different place. Like and I've had to like deviate from the plan so many different times.
Exactly. Yeah.
But for the better. Agree. You know, I mean, for I think better. That's probably something that you learned with like Boss Women Collective. Definitely something that anyone that is a creator or starts a business or an entrepreneur, like, you know, you constantly have to be adjusting based off of what life gives you and the circumstances, like day by day or week by week or month by month.
Exactly. Being okay with those pivots is so important.
Yeah. So then just another side question is what is the number one thing to do that you'd recommend everyone to put on their bucket list? It can be going somewhere. It can be doing something. It can be anything.
I would say think about the top three situations or experiences that scare you or make you nervous, and try to pick at least one every year that you do, just to fully put yourself outside of your comfort zone. So, for example, last year for me, that one of the biggest ones for me was public speaking. And I did it, and it was really scary, but it was a great opportunity to kind of push myself. This year, I'm still kind of identifying what that is, but I'm trying to really push myself to do something that I think is really uncomfortable, because I think once you do it, it helps you see that as not that crazy or that scary of a thing. And I think that's something that's like a thing that you can put on your bucket list to accomplish on a yearly basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great advice. I definitely... I got to figure that out myself. I got to figure out this year. I always feel like last few years, I mean, since I graduated college, I've done a lot, and I've gotten to a point where it's like I've really overcome so many of the things that like kind of that I was like fearful of. And they were like stupid things too. They weren't even like involved with like professional development. I know like one thing was like I was backpacking, and like someone was like, yeah, like I just did my scuba diving certification. Like that like made me terrified. I was like, I got to do that. And they were talking about like going to like 100 feet, like 30 meters or something. I was like, holy shit, that sounds like super terrifying. Like, sounds like amazing. I should do it.
Yeah,
and I did it. Exactly. I got like the basic certification. Then I did the advanced certification, and it was fine. You know, it's like, I still don't particularly like scuba diving. It's enjoyable sometimes, but like, it's, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like,
well, you still did it, so that's most important.
Yeah, it's still kind of terrifying to be like 30 meters. Like, it's like a dark down there, you know, like it's really
I don't think I could ever do that.
That's something you got to do scared. Now.
I know. I'm actually terrified of the water, so I really think I can, but maybe
I am too.
Maybe that is something I can put on my list.
No, I am too, but that's why I did it. And I feel like I'm like a little better because of it. It's pretty safe. It's actually really safe. That's why I didn't choose things that were like legitimately like dangerous. Like scuba diving. Yeah. Scuba diving, like you have to be like, it's not that dangerous. It is and it isn't, but like, no, it's very rare that someone like actually has like a bad accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good too.
But okay, cool. And then last question, actually two more questions, but one of my last questions is just, you know, how do people like get involved with like the Boss Women Collective? I mean, like, how do they find out about you? How do they find out about the events? Like, what does it take to join? Like, do you have to pay money or like, how does it work?
Yeah, so I would say about 90% of our events are free, and you can find out about the months, the events that we're hosting on a monthly basis at Boss Women Collective on Instagram or BossWomenCollective.com. We post all of our events on our monthly calendar.
Got it. And how long are the sessions? Normally, is it just like a hangout for like a couple hours, or what normally is like the agendas there? Is it pretty open or
different? It depends on if it's a strictly social event or if it's a professional event. For our social events, they're more casual coffee chats and happy hours where you can come, you know, network, meet a few new people. There's no strict agenda. For our more curated panels and workshops, you'll be given an outline on what you'll gain from attending this event. And then you can see if it's relevant to what you're hoping to gain from that specific experience. So everything that we host, we really are trying to be mindful that we're adding value to the attendees who take time out of their day or carve out time after a long day of work to come. So really try to craft that experience to fit their needs.
Cool. And so the Instagram page is Boss Women Collective. And then you said like people can just reach out to like an ambassador or like what cities primarily are you in?
Yeah, so our largest cities right now are San Francisco, New York, LA, and we just launched in Chicago. But as I mentioned, we do micro pop-ups across smaller cities that we have at least 4 members in, which are our ambassadors. So we're always interested in hosting more events. So if people are interested in, you know, collaborating on a workshop, or maybe you have a favorite coffee shop in your city that you want to host a meetup in, definitely send us a DM on Instagram, and we're happy to see what we can collaborate on.
Cool. Awesome. And then how do people follow you and get in touch with you personally? What's the best way?
Yeah, the best way is Twitter or Instagram. My handle is @RihannaSingh_. I'm pretty active on both platforms, so happy to connect with anyone.
Awesome. Cool. So those are all the main questions I had. Do you have any other, you know, other thoughts or comments or closing thoughts that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I think the last thing that I want to mention kind of on the last piece of social media is that I think it's, you know, wherever you are in your career journey, personally or professionally, it's really easy to see someone's experience on social media and start comparing it to your own and where you are at in your journey. But I think I really want to leave letting everyone know that it's okay to not always feel 100% confident or happy with where you are. But what's most important is that you start taking small baby steps each and every day to get closer to what your overarching goals are. So on your highs of high days and lows of lows, as long as you keep that mentality and take one small effort every day, I think that's most important. So wanted to just share that with everyone.
Yeah, I really, really like that piece of feedback. Yeah, because too many people focus like too much on like the end result, or not even the end result, but it's just like, it's just all about those small baby steps.
Exactly. It
takes time, you know, it's a marathon. So, okay, cool. I think, you know, that's, we're about at time. So, you know, really appreciate you taking the last, I think, 1 hour or so, sharing a bit about yourself, about your about Boss Women Collective. It sounds like a really great community, and I think a lot of people, I'm sure, get a lot of value from it. So congrats on that.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Why You Know Doctor podcast. If you want to check out some more of our content, you can follow us on social media with the handle @WYND podcast. And also, if you just have any other feedback for myself, guest suggestions, or anything else that you want to tell me, you can reach out to me directly at dominic@whyyouknowdoctor.com. So until next time, stay tuned and thanks for listening.